Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you're counting, today's rate cut by the Federal Reserve was the ninth in a row. Money is as cheap now as it's been in years. But the last time rates were this low didn't quite turn out so well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 29th of October, and it is great to have you here, especially as the Federal Reserve tries its umpteenth fix for the credit crisis. But, you know, for all the power he does have, Ben Bernanke can't actually control short-term interest rates. We'll explain how he tries real hard, though, and we will look at where the Fed might go from here with the cost of money. 1% is what it would cost you if you could walk up to the chairman of the Federal Reserve today and ask him for a loan. When you think that just over a year ago and nine rate cuts ago, the Fed funds rate was 5.25%, you do kind of have to wonder whether those cuts really are the cure for the credit squeeze. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Drops in the prices of oil and other commodities have eased inflation, and that's given the Fed room to reduce short-term interest rates to record lows. The idea is to cut the cost of loans for businesses and consumers. But Ira Kamenow of Capital Insights Group isn't sure lower interest rates will translate into cheaper loans.
Interest rates are a sideshow, even though they are historically the Federal Reserve's main tool for affecting the economy. Given the fact that the economy has been so much a victim of these awful credit markets, that's where the Federal Reserve has been doing really most of the heavy lifting.
By pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into the financial system to give banks the confidence to lend. But if they're still afraid to lend, interest rates don't have much effect on economic activity. Still, the Fed left the door open to more interest rate cuts in the future, even though there's little left in the target rate at 1%. And Villanova School of Business professor Victor Lee says more reductions could lead nowhere.
The cost of borrowing is pretty low at this point. And the difficulty right now in terms of the credit markets is not so much that it's too expensive to borrow, it's that credit's being rationed. And so even creditworthy customers are unable to get loans at current rates.
The Fed's injection of money into the system is loosening lending between banks, if not yet to you and me. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Just last week, former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan was on Capitol Hill, in part because 5 years ago he did exactly what Ben Bernanke did today, that is, cut short-term interest rates to 1%. To find out why cheap money then was bad, it is blamed in part for the housing bubble, but now somehow it's good. We've called Kenneth Rogoff at Harvard University. He's a professor of economics there. Professor, good to have you with us.
A pleasure.
What is the difference between the rate cut that Alan Greenspan gave us 5 or 6 years ago and the one that Ben Bernanke gave us today, down to 1%?
We're facing the financial mess of the century. We've been in it deep for more than a year. We're in a recession. There's really no credit flowing in the economy. Unemployment's rising. There's a global recession going on. So it's really quite appropriate to cut rates here. In fact, we see credit still very tight despite the Fed having such low interest rates.
Do you think they only did it 0.5% to give themselves a little room on the downside to cut more if they need to?
They're going to cut more. They're not done. I think we're going to end up down at zero. But they don't really want to get there because they don't know what they'll do next after it's at zero. But
down at 0%?
I think that's very likely that we're going to see that. Things are that difficult in the credit markets. It's a mess. They're having to take other measures to try to pump up liquidity in the economy.
Once you get to 0%, then what do you do if you need more rate cutting?
Well, you can't cut rates, but you can print money, basically, and drive up inflation that way. And that's really what it does. And even though that doesn't cut the interest rate, you can't go below zero, in some sense, it makes it even cheaper to borrow because you can pay back later with money that's worth less. So it is possible, in a sense, to still cut the rate that's relevant to investors. We call it the real interest rate. And Ben Bernanke's talked about that even before he became Fed governor. He criticized Japan for not doing it. Now the ball's in his court.
In the statement that the Fed issued today, they packed a lot of stuff in a couple of paragraphs. Concern about the global economy, concern about consumers here. Is there an upside to this day's events at the Federal Reserve?
Not really. I mean, it's a very difficult situation, and there's no particular end in sight. All the risks still are to the downside, especially as this crisis is morphing out into the global economy. I mean, the good news is these things don't last forever, but they don't want to get anyone's hopes up that it's going to be gone in just a few months.
Where do we go from here, then? What did the next 6 months bring us in this economy?
You know, honestly, I think when the next administration takes office, they're going to have to take much more radical steps than we've seen so far to jumpstart things, probably cast a much wider net around propping up mortgages, helping mortgage holders directly, probably a very aggressive fiscal stimulus, and a number of other policies investing in infrastructure. We're going to need to see a lot more than's been done so far. Things just aren't working yet.
Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Right alongside talk of the bailout and interest rates in Washington, there is serious discussion of another economic stimulus package. But this time, it's state governors and local officials wanting a helping hand, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
When the House Ways and Means Committee asked the mayor of Trenton, New Jersey, to describe his city's finances, Doug Palmer quoted Jack Nicholson.
The truth, you can't handle the truth.
The truth is, Trenton is firing 10% of its workforce this year, including cops and firefighters. But the city still needs to pass a 43% tax increase to balance the budget. New York's Democratic Governor David Paterson says the situation isn't any better on his side of the Hudson.
We are cutting all we can,
but
the deficit is too voluminous for us to address.
New York State's three-year projected deficit is $47 billion. This financial crisis has turned state and city budgets upside down from coast to coast. Paterson wants the federal government to fill the breach by increasing spending on infrastructure, Medicaid, food stamps, and unemployment insurance. But Governor Mark Sanford says he doesn't want another $150 billion in federal bailouts. He's a Republican from South Carolina.
If you go ahead with this, the question I think ultimately has to be asked, who bails out the bailoutor?
Sanford estimates that Congress has already spent $2 trillion trying to right the economy, and it's time to stop.
I think that there's some irony in borrowing more to deal with a problem that was ultimately created by excessive borrowing.
But at the end of the day, it seems likely Congress will do just that. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Tame, calm, boring, almost on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's the latest effort from Congress at keeping an eye on how Treasury spends that $700 billion it's got to save the economy. Don't let banks that take the bailout give executive bonuses. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle said today they think that'd be a lousy idea. Commentator David Frum says the bailout plan itself isn't so hot either, but get used to it.
Nothing is more permanent than a temporary program. That's an old saying and a true one. When the United States entered the First World War in 1917, Congress granted the president broad emergency powers over international trade. Those powers were not fully rescinded until 1975. Who knows when we'll see the end of the government's new emergency role in banks, insurance, and possibly automobiles and pension funds as well. We may think we are fighting fires, but we are also unintentionally building institutions that could endure for some considerable time. Institutions that nobody much wants, but that we have no clear plans for liquidating. Decisions made in haste and without much thought in 2008 may end up profoundly shaping the economy of 2018 or 2028 or 2038. The government may soon feel compelled to order banks to lend. Once government gets accustomed to this power, it will not be so easily surrendered. We need exit strategies. It's urgent that every emergency action be matched with a plan to undo that action. Sunset clauses in the law, countervailing powers within the executive. How about impaneling an independent board to monitor and report on progress toward the early termination of the government role in finance? Or creating in the Treasury Department an assistant secretary for privatization and liquidation to counterbalance the assistant secretary who already exists, who now runs the troubled asset program. The humble title of assistant secretary conceals enormous power, and we will need an equally aggressive official to offset that power. As James Madison warned two centuries ago, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interests of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. Above all, we will desperately need from the press, the Congress, and the people constant questioning, scrutiny, and pressure against this unwanted, undesirable, and unsustainable new federal role in banking and finance.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Online is best. Go to marketplace.org, and all you have to do is click on that link that says Contact. The list of losers in the financial crisis is already pretty long. Wall Street banks, hedge funds, mortgage lenders, not to mention American consumers and taxpayers. Didn't want you to think I'd forgotten about them. But don't forget about private equity groups, too. Those huge piles of privately controlled capital that are used to buy up attractive companies. Until a couple of years ago, the only people who really talked about private equity firms were Wall Street insiders and us, sometimes. Then companies like the Carlyle Group and KKR and Blackstone started pulling off multi-billion dollar deals and making headlines. And they were able to do that thanks to easy credit. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explains what happens to private equity now that credit has dried up.
Private equity firms are known as the scavengers of Wall Street. They buy up vulnerable companies and either fix them up and take them public or sell them for parts. Here's Danny DeVito as Larry the Liquidator.
You got equipment here that cost $120 million. Even at salvage, it's worth $30, $35 million.
You can't come into my town, take my company. You can't do that.
What, have you been living on Mars, Yorgie? It's called a corporate takeover.
Private equity firms financed those deals mostly with debt. And as borrowing got easier and cheaper over the last 5 years, targets got bigger. Suddenly, even multinational corporations were within reach. Adam Leshinsky follows private equity for Fortune magazine.
Just in the same way that a homeowner who couldn't afford a home could get a mortgage for it anyway, a private equity firm could get so much debt so inexpensively that it could buy bigger companies than it ever could before.
Cerberus bought Chrysler for $7.5 billion. Harrah's went to TPG Capital and Apollo Group for $18 billion. The Blackstone Group bought Hilton Hotels for $26 billion. Susan Chaplinsky is with the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. She says private equity firms now control 67,000 companies worldwide.
They became a much, much larger share of our economy. If the companies don't perform well, the impact on our economy is going to be much larger and more significant.
That's already happening. Blackstone went public last year for $31 a share. It's now trading at less than $9 a share. TPG and Apollo borrowed $9 billion to buy Harrah's. Since then, the casino giant's profits have collapsed. Chaplinsky says a lot of private equity firms owe more on their deals than those deals are now worth, and some may not survive.
I think you will see a shakeout, a reordering of the industry, and the weaker firms fall out and the better firms grow stronger.
Private equity deals are down more than 70% from last year. But for companies with cash, it's prime shopping season.
There are tremendous opportunities being created in this economy.
Joe Schocken is CEO of Seattle-based private equity firm Broadmark Capital.
We are focused on a whole series of new investment opportunities in healthcare, in information technology, in the environmental services, in financial services, and in infrastructure.
But it's not private equity business as usual. Gone are the days of cheap debt and massive leveraging.
The attention to basic credit standards, basic underwriting, and fundamental value, that will all be back. And honestly, it should never have gone away.
That's Stuart Cole, a CEO of the Riverside Company. The Cleveland-based firm has been taking companies private for 20 years. He says bargain shoppers could see stellar returns.
In private equity, we often use the term of vintages, and 2005 through 2007 might not come out of the wine cellar with great returns, but 2009 through 2010 or 11 might generate exciting returns.
Investors think so, too. They've poured more than $200 billion into American private equity funds this year. That's 10% more than last year. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, the Chinese toy trade branches out.
It'll always shift to the lowest cost country, whether that be Indonesia, whether that be Cambodia, Laos, possibly even Africa. It's always going to keep on moving.
But first, let's do the numbers. That rate cut didn't do too much for the markets, which ended mixed today. The Dow Industrials eased back 0.8%, 74 points, to close at 8,990. The Nasdaq nudged up 0.4%, 7 points, finished at 1657. The S&P 500 ended 1.1% lower, down 10 points, closed at 930. Still holding the spotlight with more cost-cutting plans, General Motors drove up 8% today. Visa rang up 1% despite posting its first loss as a public company. MGM Mirage hit the jackpot with a 33% gain today, that after the company announced funding for one of its projects. Other gaming companies really cashed in on the idea of fresh money for that sector. Las Vegas Sands gained 80%. Wynn Resorts jumped 26%. Financials gave up some of the ground they made yesterday. JP Morgan dropped 5%. Bank of America lost 3%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.86%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. What's the connection between champagne and collateralized debt obligations? Head on over to our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos uncorking the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Thursday. The Bureau of Economic Analysis releases the third quarter GDP report. The ASPCA announces the winners of the 2008 Humane Awards to deserving dogs, cats, and people. And on this day in 1938, Orson Welles broadcast his anxiety-inducing radio play, The War of the Worlds. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So here's how perilous things are for General Motors. Not only are they in talks with Chrysler about a merger to see both of them through to the other side of this recession, but Japanese papers say GM CEO Rick Wagner is going to meet with executives at Toyota to ask them for help, too. Meanwhile, GM announced today worldwide sales fell 11% last quarter. There's still no word on whether Washington's going to pony up the $10 billion GM says it needs to make that Chrysler deal work. And there are reports the company is going to cut costs by cutting back on new products. Interesting decision, seeing as how they got into trouble in the first place by not making cars that Americans wanted to buy. Marketplace's Renita Jablonski has more.
Here's one way to save $1.5 billion. Stop spending on engineering, design, and development. That's what GM plans to do in 2009 and 2010, according to a report today in Automotive News. GM spokesman Tom Wilkinson says slow down.
GM is continuing to invest in the cars and trucks that will make a difference for the company.
But the report says the spending cutback could delay the introduction of key products like the Chevy Cruze. The compact's expected to get about 40 miles a gallon on the highway.
Jim Cashman is a management professor at the University of Alabama. He's also been a consultant to companies including GM for about 20 years. Cashman says he wouldn't be surprised if GM slashes development budgets.
They have little choice.
Cashman says putting development spending in the garage can be an effective way to cut costs, so long as it doesn't go on too long.
What is absolutely fundamental to the future of the big three and GM being way up in front of that is to build in much more ability to react to customer shifts in demand.
Cutbacks, wherever they come, will not include the Chevy Volt, the plug-in car expected in a couple years. GM's also planning to reintroduce an oldie and what it hopes is a goodie.
Chevy Camaro Z28, with a kind of suspension.
GM's Wilkinson says a new Camaro may have the muscle to pull in new buyers.
A lot of the people who used to buy Camaros, a lot of them actually went into full-size trucks.
That they're now looking to get out of. I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
With car makers already nervous about the future, today's oil news might have them wondering if they should hit the brakes on all those plans they have for fuel-efficient cars. This morning, the Energy Department reported crude inventories were up, but the increase was a million barrels short of what was expected, and gasoline stockpiles actually fell. So, come on now, America. Admit it. It's just you and me. Are lower prices at the pump luring you back to your old habits? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
When oil started plunging, a research executive at GM said his worst nightmare was prices falling to $65 a barrel. He worried aloud that Americans might not downsize if gasoline tipped below $3.50 a gallon. Well, average pump prices are now far below that, and Tom Kloza of the Oil Price Information Service sees signs at least some of us are backsliding.
It could be a little bit of a sugar rush where the consumer goes back to essentially some bad behavior, some behavior that in the long run isn't going to help.
Already, U.S. pickup demand is back on the rise after collapsing earlier this year. Their sales share is nearly what it was before oil prices hit their high-end tipping point. Kloza says so much for car buyers being changed forever.
They should not get lulled into a false sense of security in thinking that high prices are not around the corner.
But oil economist Jim Williams believes even truck buyers are still watching fuel economy.
I think everybody that buys a vehicle right now is really thinking, what's the mileage going to be and could it go up again? I don't think Hummer sales are going to skyrocket.
Oil researcher Tom Kloza says prices will go up again, and there's no way of knowing how long the current slump will last. And it's now, he says, the country needs leadership that won't allow Americans to backslide again.
If we start to emerge from the economic recession and find that oil prices are going higher, it'll be like sort of catching a second round of pneumonia after recovery.
Kloza says that's something all Americans can prevent if they can resist those lower pump prices. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Tomorrow morning, we're going to get our first hard numbers for how the economy did in the third quarter. We can all probably guess gross domestic product July through September wasn't all that great. We'd be lucky, really, if there was any growth at all, because there certainly hasn't been in one of the key components of this economy, and the global economy too, American consumer spending. When we don't buy, the rest of the world feels it, especially in Asia, where so many economies count on being able to sell their exports here. Just in time for the holiday shopping season, Chinese toy makers are suffering. Marketplace's Scott Tong stopped at a toy expo in Shanghai to check things out.
Step into Shanghai's International Toy Industry Fair, and the first impression is sensory overload. Plastic race cars loop the loop, and helicopters hover endlessly. Which brings us to the second impression. When will the batteries die? For Chinese toy makers, the power is already draining. Wu Haining manufactures for export clients like Walmart, Kmart, and Target.
This year we've suffered in a very obvious way. Orders from the U.S. and Europe have fallen 70% from last year. Toys just aren't a necessity for consumers right now.
Word here is U.S. orders were already weak this year, and then they cratered with the global slowdown. For 2008, some 4,000 Chinese toy exporters have gone under. That's half the industry.
Gone are the days when factories could operate mindlessly like Robbie the robot. Chinese manufacturers simply took an order, loaded the ship, and raked in double-digit profits. That's changed in the last year. Soccer moms in the West are now pinching pennies. And the other part of this story is China is no longer the lowest-cost manufacturer. Labor costs are up, so some customers have abandoned China for cheaper, less developed shores. Jeff Sears is a furniture importer from Michigan.
It'll always shift to the lowest-cost country, whether that be Indonesia, whether that be Cambodia, Laos, possibly even Africa. It's always going to keep on moving.
Remember last year's recalls of Chinese-made toys with lead paint? Many Western brands immediately hightailed it to Thailand. That way they could peel off that Made in China sticker. David Dayton is a quality consultant with Silk Road International. He says Chinese factory bosses are now desperate, and in general, they're unprepared.
The idea of forecasting is not something that we run into very often with Chinese-owned factories. It very much seems to us, boy, they're not looking past this order.
Next week, Beijing will boost subsidies for toy and other exporters. But many think the country's long-term plan is to let them die. Attorney Steve Dickinson is with the firm Harrison Morey.
They really want to phase out, to put it in a nice way, the manufacturing that is very low technology and requires a massive number of low-skilled, low-wage laborers.
So it's time for China to redesign the car and craft a new business model. Ye Guoxiang exports wooden toys. He wants to wean himself off foreign buyers and start selling to Chinese consumers. They're getting wealthier by the day. Here he is back at the Shanghai Toy Fair.
The China market is a better prospect. Parents here have just one child, and these days they spend on them. It's different than the 70s, when our parents could only afford food and clothes.
This Christmas season, parents in the U.S. won't be buying much either. Some analysts predict the weakest holiday sales in 17 years. So by the time January rolls around, the global slowdown may cause hundreds, maybe thousands more Chinese factories to close. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today proved positive that maybe the 15 minutes that Andy Warhol said we'd all be famous one day might actually be too much. Just when you thought all the hubbub about Joe the plumber had died down, comes word that he's got an agent. Joe Wurzelbacher, the Ohio plumber that John McCain made famous, has signed with a Nashville management company to deal with all the media requests he's gotten, one of which came from a major record label. Wurzelbacher, according to his agent, apparently plays a little guitar. Can't sing much, though. And there is this in real news. There is late word this afternoon that the FDIC and the Treasury Department are working on a mortgage guarantee plan to help about 3 million homeowners who are at risk of foreclosure. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow down 74 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq rose 7 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 down 6 points, 0.6% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. And coming up next time, another installment of our series, Working, looking at the life of an individual in the global economy. This time, a pirate of the high seas. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.